those of us in the prosperous West are behaving extraordinarily recklessly.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm David Rothkopf, CEO and editor, and you're listening to The ER. Today, I'm in New York City with FP's deputy editor for the magazine, Sayward Darby. Joining us from D.C. is FP contributor Rosa Brooks, senior Future of War fellow at New America and professor at Georgetown University. And finally, joining us from Palo Alto is Corey Shockey, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, where she focuses on military history. A quick thank you to everybody who submitted ideas to us. We've received loads and loads of great suggestions, admittedly because you want a mug and you like free stuff and not really because you care about intellectual discourse. But that's fine. It makes us feel as though you want us and you care about us and we're needy. So we're grateful. If you have any other ideas or questions or comments, you can certainly email us at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com. Recently, from our tiny podcast studio high above DuPont Circle and another podcast studio high above cool and trendy Brooklyn, we had the following conversation. So, guys, I've been thinking about a question, and I'd really like your response to the question. And the question is, who has the world's stupidest electorate? I'll give you a few choices you could pick from, but you could pick another. Certainly the United States, which via its Republican electorate has now picked Donald Trump as the Republican nominee for president, is in the running. He even seems to be doing pretty well in the polls and has a chance of being the next president of the United States, which has me thinking about other countries like the ones that I will move to live in if that actually happens. Then, of course, we have the British electorate, which recently made a vote to leave the EU, apparently had some amount of remorse shortly after that vote, and then put in place a new leadership in the Conservative Party that really is extraordinary. So you actually have an environmental minister who's pro-fox hunting. I didn't even know that was a thing you could be anymore. You have a development minister who's against development assistance, and you have a foreign secretary who everybody in the world hates. And within seconds of his appointment, the French immediately said, this is a liar. This sort of thing doesn't happen. But, you know, they really have come up with an extraordinary group of people to lead that country as it dwindles into being just England and Wales in a few years. And then, of course, you have the Turkish electorate who've chosen Erdogan democratically, even as Erdogan is using every available means to undercut democracy and move in the direction of rather repulsive autocracy. And I say this fully cognizant of the coup attempt against him, which has generated from me zero sympathy. So, Corey, dumbest electorate from those three, or is there something I'm missing?
I actually don't think Turkey belongs in that category. I grant you the point that those of us in the prosperous West are behaving extraordinarily recklessly, that we have for so long not felt consequences of bad choices, that we're making bad choices. But the people of Turkey, I actually think, deserve a lot more credit than you're giving them, David. First of all, it was beautiful and noble to see that when the Turkish military was fomenting a coup, that average Turkish people were willing to lay down in front of tanks, were willing to take sticks and counter a military that was objecting to counter a military that was trying to overthrow the government. But what makes it even more beautiful and noble is that so many of the Turks involved in those protests, especially in Istanbul, but elsewhere around the country, those people are actually opponents of the Erdogan government. So they're not turning out in support of a government they like. They're turning out in support of the process that you can't overthrow the government by military force. And that's a beautiful and a noble thing. And so I don't think they deserve that. The second point about Turkey is that, you know, it is an overwhelmingly Muslim society. It's been in a process of democratization for about 20 years. I think the last successful military coup in Turkey was 1997. They're groping towards something other countries haven't managed to do very well. Possibly Indonesia is a better example. But other than Indonesia, are there countries that have been military dictatorships that have transitioned to be democracies when the majority of the population is Islamic? Turkey's struggling towards a model, and its democratization will mean its Islamization, as I think we have seen with Erdogan. But I agree with your judgment that the Erdogan government is profoundly undemocratic and is using the levers of power to try and foreclose the counterbalancing forces that make democracies representative of societies.
So say we're, Corey used the term noble, that these are noble people, opponents of Erdogan, standing up for the democratic process. Now, first of all, we don't know the origins of the coup, and we don't know who these people were, and we don't know any of the backstory. And we certainly see Erdogan implementing post-coup a whole set of policies that actually advance his pre-coup agenda and are clearly dramatically overreaching beyond the coup plotters. I mean, you've got judges, you've got police, you've got academics, you've got journalists, you've got thousands and thousands of people being rounded up or fired from their jobs. So whatever the origins of the coup, after the coup, there's less democracy than there was before it. And before the coup, democracy was dwindling. So is it really nobility to be standing up for democracy as it withers before you and for the person who is actively trying to undercut it, or is it foolish?
I mean, I think that those two words are not sort of the only options, because I think that if you are to use, you know, Corey's example of, you know, citizens who are not supporters of Erdogan and they see a coup happening, the question is, if we support the coup, like, where do we, what happens next? And it's a complete unknown. In some ways, it's sort of a catch-22 for them, because if they support the military, they have no idea what that means other than, you know, the democratic process has been completely undone. But they don't know, you know, what their lives will be like, what the government will be like. And if they support Erdogan, they know that he's a terribly undemocratic leader. And they probably are, you know, intelligent enough to know that, you know, if the coup fails, he's not going to magically become more democratic. So it's not necessarily noble or foolish. It's sort of, you know, making the best decision they can in what seems to have been, like, I mean, a certainly surprising and very emotional moment. So, you know, it's, as I've been reading the news over the last couple of days about this, I found myself putting myself in the shoes of these people and thinking, you know, what would I have done? What would I think now? And I think the most interesting question, and I would be really curious to hear what Corey and Rosa have to say about this, is what is the noble response from those people now? Now that Erdogan has overreached, now that he has, you know, fired tens of thousands of people, detained thousands of people, those who opposed the coup but also have problems with that, what is their move?
Yeah,
right. Particularly if Rosa, just to,
I'd
like to hear your answer, but particularly if what Erdogan is doing is dismantling the democratic means of responding to him, is actually the post-coup pro-democratic response a coup?
Right.
No, I mean, this obviously, we all live in a country that was founded on the principle that when a government no longer represents the people have the right to overthrow it by force if necessary to change the government. And that's one of our founding principles. And you know, it's all very well, obviously, to say, and Corey's right to say, gee, Erdogan may be a creep in a million different ways, but they did elect him, and the military shouldn't just overthrow him. You're supposed to turn to the ballot box. But David, yeah, when Erdogan does what he is now doing, which is continuing and dramatically accelerating his sort of pre-existing efforts to utterly dismantle any platforms from which democratic critics could arise. Purges throughout academia, thousands and thousands of teachers, professors, deans fired, purges of the judicial system and so forth. You know, at a certain point, he may have been elected democratically, but that doesn't mean he's governing democratically. And at a certain point, yeah, what's left? What options are left for the Turkish people? And it's easy for us to sort of preachily say, well, you know, you still must aim for peaceful resistance and use the ballot box. But when those options are foreclosed, it's unclear what's going to happen. I saw it amazingly, apparently a full quarter of Turkey's general officers are now in prison, which is amazing. You know, this was not obviously a coup that was engineered by a tiny group of people. This was clearly a coup that at least the Erdogan government believes was engineered by and or had the support of, you know, a huge percentage of the Turkish armed forces and probably of substantial and equal percentage of the Turkish people. I agree with Corey, though, that I don't think the people are dumb. It's not the dumbest electorate. I think the people are stuck. Yes. That's not dissimilar to the situation in some of the other countries that you mentioned, which hopefully we will get to. But, they're stuck. They have no good choices.
Okay. Well, look, I want to get to those other countries. Let me pose two questions more about Turkey, for which I would like to get kind of brief answers in the 30-second to a minute variety so that we can then move on to those other countries. First of all, you know, Erdogan is not just behaving badly at home. He's been behaving badly in the region for quite a while, supporting some Islamist actors in places like Libya in ways that ought to be troubling. Hasn't been much of a great cooperator with us on a lot of the issues associated with Syria. And, you know, there is an argument to be made that the West, and particularly Obama, who loved Erdogan at the beginning, and one of his early quotes was, of all the world leaders, you know, who do you get along with the best? His response was Erdogan. We haven't used the levers that we've got with the Turks to get them to behave in the region in a particularly good way. And all of this sort of was cast into really stark focus when post-coup they started taking some of the people who'd been arrested and putting them at Incirlik Air Force Base, where there are 60 U.S. nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
So this is not a kind of an abstraction as far as U.S. foreign policy goes. Should we change or reconsider our relationship with Turkey while it moves away from democracy and while it doesn't behave in the region? And should that include a reassessment of its role within NATO, Corey?
Yes, we should reconsider our relationship with Turkey. I think the likeliest trajectory for Erdogan, given how ruthless and authoritarian his actions have been, and not just in the aftermath of the coup attempt, but before it. In fact, one of the most interesting assessments I've seen of the coup attempt is that it might have been that Erdogan's crackdown might have been planned, and the coup attempt was an effort to stave it off, which would be interesting if true. But I think the likeliest trajectory for Erdogan is an Iranian-Russian-Turkish alignment. The similarities are striking. I think the interests align in lots of ways. And of course, that should cause us to reevaluate our relationship with Turkey. As you know, there is no there's no provision in the NATO treaty for bouncing out a member. And Greece and Turkey had coups in the 1970s and remained NATO members. But I do think the norms of democratic values are advancing, and we ought to be reinforcing for the Turks that what the NATO treaty requires of its members is to consult and evaluate what to do in the event a member needs defense. And we might be slow to that defense if Turkey doesn't more greatly respect the rights of its people.
Rosa.
Well, I was very much reminded of the debates surrounding the U.S. responses to the coup in Egypt a few years back, which we refused to call a coup because we were so tied up in knots about, oh, yeah, we don't like this, but on the other hand, we need them. But on the other hand, you know, what are we going to do? And it, you know, interestingly, there are, you know, one of the many conspiracy theories in Turkey right now is that the U.S. government actively supported the coup attempt. I'm inclined to doubt that. But nevertheless, a recent poll within Turkey suggests that 3/4 of Turks believe it to be the case. And it certainly raises the now hypothetical question, but it's still probably illuminating to think about, of what would the U.S. have done if the coup had succeeded? You know, would we have called it a coup, or would we have found some, you know, squishy way to try to say, well, you know, they're actually restoring democracy. Well, it's complicated. And we might have. I mean, we don't know enough. And it's frustrating how little, at least in the public domain, has gotten out about exactly what was motivating the coup plotters. I wish I knew more. But you know, now we're once again in a bind that, as Corey said, is partly of our own making. We don't want to do without our bases in Turkey and our access to other places that flow through Turkey. So we are scared of saying too much that pushes Erdogan too far away from us and into the arms of states that we don't like, such as Corey suggested, Iran, Russia, et cetera. But equally, we don't like what he's doing. And so we're unfortunately, I think we are at the moment are falling into what has a little too often been the usual response, which is that we're kind of being wishy-washy and not doing much. And we are alienating absolutely everybody on all sides by our failure to clarify exactly what we think and exactly what we want.
Exactly right. Sayward.
Yeah, I agree with what's been said. I think that, you know, this does definitely require a reevaluation of the relationship. But, you know, sort of like the Turkish people, we're in a sense stuck as well. And I think it's absolutely important for the U.S. to publicly clarify that, you know, it supports democratic norms. It in no way supports what's happening with the purges and arrests. But I think that in some ways, yes, like alienating people on all sides at once is incredibly, you know, frustrating and difficult to watch. But at the same time, it has to be weighed that, you know, one wrong move could, you know, push Erdogan in a direction that it's then even harder to pull Turkey back from. So, you know, I think that a reevaluation is certainly necessary, and it's just a little unclear what that will look like and what it should look like. Also, to something that Corey said initially, and this sort of ties in another of our countries, David, that you mentioned, you know, NATO doesn't have provisions for bouncing a member. And similarly, the EU is largely constructed with no, like, clear exit strategy articulated. And, you know, that's by design, right?
British,
because you start
own
these alliances, and, like, why would you want people to see a way out, right? But I do think it raises questions, both with what's going on with Turkey, with the Brexit, and then, you know, prior to that, with what was going on in Greece. And I think we even had some columns about this at the time. You know, what do you do when a member is behaving so badly, doing something that is so in violation of the terms of whatever the alliance might be? Should there be provisions for bouncing?
Well, I think that's a rhetorical question, right? There should be provisions. There should be provisions for pre-bouncing. There should be provisions,
sure,
for penalizing countries.
Well,
or,
I mean,
putting them on
there
warning
are.
Or
but
something.
From a legal perspective, there are. I mean, regardless of the precise language in the treaty, you know, there are clear international law procedures for what you do when you believe that a party to a multilateral treaty has breached its terms materially in one way or another. So I mean, this is a political failure. It's not that there's no mechanism. It's that states are unwilling to use those mechanisms because they don't know what to do. And I would note, of course, that NATO is a mutual defense treaty. It's not a we heart democracy and human rights treaty.
Right.
So while we could certainly, you know, that's why, again, this is not a NATO treaty problem of, oh, gee whiz, there's no mechanism for responding. This is we have no idea what to do, and therefore we're not doing anything problem.
Well, I'm not fully sure that that's the case, because everything you said is true. When you get to a common defense treaty, it was designed around a particular potential enemy, but it hasn't been updated to reflect other enemies. And if, in fact, NATO sees another threat from Islamist extremism, for example, and a NATO member starts supporting Islamist extremists, then they may not be in technical violation of the treaty under the laws that you're talking about, but they're certainly in violation of the spirit of the treaty.
No, but that's my point, is that it's a political problem. It's not a
okay.
Yeah, I mean, there are absolutely, you know, if other NATO states decided that they really wanted to boot Turkey out of NATO, they could do so. If they decided they wanted to create other kinds of penalties or submit it to arbitration or do any number of other things, they could do so. And at the moment, they are choosing instead to wring their hands. Maybe they'll do something later, but you know, this is as usual. I mean, this goes back to some of our earlier discussions about the role of law. You know, and you can't disentangle law and politics fully ever. You know, it's there's no such thing as a legal failure. It's always a political failure.
Okay, my one last 1 minute response question. You know, you may not remember that parameter because it was like a half an hour ago, but has to do with at least something that was a cousin of what Corey said. As worrying as the coup and the post-coup developments are in Turkey, something else is troubling me. And that it has to do with something that happened in Turkey 2 weeks before the coup when there was a terror attack. And the terror attack took place involving somebody from Dagestan, somebody from Uzbekistan, and somebody from Azerbaijan. And that's significant because, you know, the reason that the Russians have been so deeply worried about this is their fear of Islamist extremism spreading up not only into the Caucasus, but into Central Asia. And one of the reasons that the United States is even playing footsie now with the Russians in Syria is some concern about this. And the Russian-Iranian-Turkish potential alignment that Corey talked about can be focused on that. And one of the things that worries me is that, you know, we tend to focus on this year's crisis and this year's source of threat. And we are really ill prepared for dealing with a situation where extremism is spreading north and where these players all have a different role. And countries like Russia are likely to be much more active because it's really a local issue for them. And the alliance between the Russians and the Iranians and potentially countries like Turkey might really change the balance of power in the region. And I, by the way, think the same exact thing is going to happen in North and Sub-Sahel Africa. And so I'm just wondering what your views are on the idea that we may be seeing a kind of a realignment in terms of the extremist threat. One that could potentially be exacerbated if there was protracted instability in Turkey. Corey.
An interesting and a hard question, David. I do think that we have missed quite a number of opportunities since September 11th and maybe even before to help the Russians fight terrorism in a way that doesn't legitimate their behavior in Chechnya and other things we don't like. So we've missed a bunch of opportunities, and I'm not sure, given where the Putin government has gone, that we can recapture any potential cooperation with them. Moreover, I think the efforts to do so in Syria have reached a point of being obscene. John Kerry saying several days ago that we and the Russians understand together what Syria needs. It is actually really damaging to American interests in the Middle East because Russia's behavior has gone so far in contrast to the interests of the Syrian people fighting their government that we're going to now be associated with what the Russians are doing. And I think we haven't been careful enough about that. But I think the honest answer to your question, now that I have bought myself enough time to think about it, is Rosa's answer from earlier, which is that we actually need a policy that navigates better than our policy does the the legitimate interests of people fighting against terrorism and countries fighting against terrorism versus our interest in human rights and basic decency. We actually haven't negotiated that space very well. And I think that's the biggest impediment to us doing what you suggest, David.
Sayward.
I completely agree with that. One of the very first things you said was, missed opportunities. And I think, with regard to some of these Central Asian countries or countries in the Caucasus, there are also so many missed opportunities because you've been seeing undemocratic governments in these places flourish. Azerbaijan is actually a perfect example of this. They have just gotten worse and worse as the years have gone by, I think. And there have just been so many missed opportunities by the United States to articulate a policy of, yes, we support, a fight to make sure that Islamist extremism does not become, a problem within your borders. But at the same time, we don't support you doing that in an undemocratic way. And I feel like there's just been this like muddling along of sort of allowing these undemocratic places to really blossom in that sense. Uzbekistan is another good example of this. And, there really have been so many missed opportunities. That's kind of the story with the human rights, counterterrorism sort of area. But I do think it's a matter of more clearly articulating it and deciding, what our relationships are going to be with these countries where we have missed these opportunities.
Rose it.
Yeah, I think obviously these are issues that the U.S. has struggled with for decades, and we are uncomfortable. We can't find policies because we're ourselves so deeply conflicted. And President Obama has said many times, and he's right, the fact that we prefer something doesn't mean that we can get it, and it doesn't necessarily mean that putting our capital, economic, political, military, into trying to get it is worth it given all the other interests we have. And he's certainly right about those things. But I think in practice, when we get these complicated situations where we have a set of security interests, which we think push in one direction, our commitment to democracy and rights, we think pushes us another direction. We're not actually so sure how much leverage we have anyway over anything. That we are so uncomfortable with finding ourselves in that dilemma that in recent, sometimes at times we've kind of oscillated rather dramatically towards one or the other. I think it's fair to say that during the Reagan era, the security tended to Trump, for instance. But the sort of Obama solution is, I don't want to oscillate too much in one direction or the other, but that just keeps landing us in this sort of untenable, conflicted state of middle paralysis. Again, to be fair, I don't think that there is an answer. But I do think that our sort of discomfort with our own options and our inability to really, we're not very creative about thinking, are there ways we can simultaneously be promoting the values we care about and promoting our security interests? If we're doing that, how do we solve the problem of multiple audiences of at the same time, reassuring those we need to reassure on the security front while reassuring those that we need to reassure credibly on the human rights front? We don't know how to do it.
Well, let's go back in the few remaining minutes we've got to those other wonderful countries that we had started out talking about. And let's just spend a minute or two hearing you riff on the developments that have taken place there. Let's start with the United Kingdom, soon to be one of the great oxymorons in country names of recent history, as it Brexits and possibly has Scotland leave and possibly sees Ireland reunited. It's got a new government. It's got a foreign secretary who makes Donald Trump look like Benjamin Disraeli. Well, possibly not, but who's a bozo. What do we think?
So I think the Brexit vote will probably be viewed as one of the most foolish political decisions by a prime minister ever. David Cameron's government thought they were brilliant tacticians and in fact turned out not to be. There's this wonderful New Yorker cartoon probably 20 years ago that showed two little kids standing in front of a map. And on the map, you see Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and England. And the one boy says to the other, "This is the United Kingdom. It's where Great Britain used to be." And I feel like we might be seeing the very next stage of that because, David, as you suggested, I think that the Brexit vote will legitimate an additional Scottish referendum. I think the pieces could well come apart unless the British government proves itself, this British government proves itself much more adept and able than its conservative predecessor.
Shayward?
I think that, you know, everything you just said, it raises the question, who does look good coming out of this? Because certainly the...
Well, Nigel Farage was invited to the Republican convention by Donald Trump.
Well, then clearly he's the winner here. No, but, you know, the architects of the Leave campaign certainly don't look so hot. David Cameron, as you say, proves to be a terrible tactician, as does the other people in his administration. You know, Boris... We're just not even going to talk about Boris. And, you know, the new government obviously still has a lot to prove. That's incredibly fresh. But I would argue maybe the only person who does come out looking good is Nicola Sturgeon in Scotland. And I think you're right, Corey. I think there will be another referendum because, you know, the Scottish are probably like, wait, we voted on the basis of thinking one thing. And now this thing just doesn't even exist anymore. So but I can't think of a political mess of late where so few people came out, even the winners came out looking terrible.
Nicola Sturgeon, by the way, is the winner.
Yeah.
in case you hadn't figured it
no,
out.
No, but I mean, it's a matter of, you know, winners, losers, but also just like who looks good, who seems to have navigated this well. And it just seems like on all sides, people are just collapsing left and right as the fallout occurred.
Well, but I mean, one of the things is that Nicola Sturgeon could be the first prime minister of the new Republic of
yes.
Scotland, and Theresa May could be the last prime minister of a
yes.
truly united kingdom.
Yes.
So, you know, that's one way to look at it. Rosa, your take on the sceptered isle.
Well, David, since my mind at this point in the podcast turns relentlessly to trivia, I want to address the likely impact on cuisine available in the United Kingdom. The great
vital questions.
The greatest contribution of first the European Community, then the EU and its looser immigration rules to Britain was that it took a sceptered isle that had really crappy food, consisting largely of fish and chips and baked and boiled potatoes and meats that were unrecognizable, and it brought in immigrants who brought in food. Good food from all over the world, thank God. And now I fear that this may begin to decline once more. And as a once and future tourist, I'm very depressed about that.
Well, the upside is that, you know, potentially closer links between Scotland and the EU will help you avoid
bad
haggis
food
is
and
the only item on the
point.
Menu.
Haggis and herring.
Right.
Which is, you know, it's pretty awful. Thank you, Rosa, for that perspective. I think that... The more we talk about food, the better we are on this thing. But let me turn then for our final segment here to our regular appetite suppressant, where I play word association with one word.
I think I can guess that word.
Corey.
Yes?
Trump, a great moment. Now the official candidate of your party. Melania Trump, the next First Lady of the United States. Donald Trump said, based on publicity, that her speech was now the most important political speech ever given, which immediately had the Twitterverse raising a question bigger than the Gettysburg Address.
I wish I could say it's funny, but this is actually tragic. It's terrible for the Republican Party. It's terrible for the United States of America. And it's actually bad for countries that rely on us for their security, that view us as an example of how of a country of laws, not of men. It's terrible for American soft power. It's terrible for the advance of individual liberty around the world. it's not funny. It's really sad. And Republicans have no one to blame but ourselves for this.
Well, let me articulate a possible happy ending here. And I realize this is completely...
Does this involve snacks?
No snacks are involved. And I realize this is totally Pollyanna-ish. The New York Times had a thing on the front cover yesterday saying that their experts have decided that Hillary Clinton has a 76% chance of winning. And I thought, well, wait a minute. That means that Trump basically has, you know, in four tosses of the coin, he wins once. Yikes. That's kind of a little too big for comfort. But nevertheless, if in fact Trump is defeated, as we still think, you know, the odds favor that, here's a possible good outcome, right? I mean, all of the things that make Trump horrible, which Corey has alluded to, are very and frighteningly real. But there's a funny way in which Trump has brought to the surface stuff that many of us, including many in the Republican Party, were able to deny to themselves existed. You know, that this has basically brought all the racist assholes out of the rocks they were under and out into the open. It has brought all the xenophobia, you know, out into the open. And I think the Republican Party in particular, but also parts of the Democratic Party and the Democratic electorate, you know, that we tried to pretend that that yucky stuff wasn't there because it made us uncomfortable. And we simultaneously, you know, party leaders in many ways simultaneously accommodated it while pretending that it wasn't there. The fact that it is now out in the open, I think, has been a huge shock to many, both mainstream and moderate Republicans, and to many Democrats, you know, are kind of going, oh, my God, I had no idea there were so many people in this country willing to say those things. That's appalling. You know, and is it bad and scary? Yeah. But frankly, I think if Clinton ends up winning in the end, we will ultimately be better off as a nation that this came out in the open so we can deal with it, because we were all pretending it wasn't there, you know. And I think that this is forcing us, and even in some ways, you know, even all the paroxysm about policing and police use of force, distressing as all these discussions are for all of us and wrenching, you know, and hard to have, that these are discussions that we have to have. We're better off having. You push this stuff under the rug, you know, it manages to last longer in insidious ways. So while I will be very, very scared if Trump, in fact, wins, I think if Clinton wins, you know, that this may in the end up being an opportunity for a long overdue national reckoning with this pretty nasty underside of American politics and culture.
Since this is the argument that I've been hearing every day from the woman with whom I live.
Oh, really?
I cannot refute
it. She's brilliant.
Because I am the second smartest person in my house.
It's good to know your place.
But it is absolutely crystal clear to me. Sayward.
So this reminds me, I should preface this by saying that I'm from the South. I'm from a small town in the South. And after Obama was elected...
I'm hearing banjo music in the background.
Yeah. My people do make moonshine. So after Obama was elected, I remember having conversations with people who were just so excited, ecstatic, you know, that this election proved, you know, the issue of racism in America was, you know, in the best place it had ever been. And there was just this kind of, it was amazing to me, because then I would go home and I would see the Confederate flags and I would hear people use the N-word and I would hear people, you know, call him a Muslim, you know, say, you know, he should be assassinated, whatever. And then I would come back. This is when I was living in Washington, but then ultimately New York. And it was like being inside the bubble and outside the bubble. And so, Rosa, I think you're right that there was this denial of what existed. And in large part, that was amongst like political elites. Because if you spent time in places where a lot of this more conservative base is, you heard it all the time.
Yeah.
And the one thing that, well, two things. But I think that, David, to really circle back to the beginning of your conversation asking, like, who is the dumbest electorate? And to tie that into what Rosa said about needing to have this reckoning, I think a very important part of that reckoning going forward is to not consider these, as you said, racist assholes, which they're jerks, but to not just say you're dumb, you are wrong, but to ask, like, what impulse, what things that inform your reality have made you think this? And, you know, what can the government, what can liberals, what can other people do to say, okay, let's not just like, you know, push you back under a different rug, but ask what has like led us to this point. Is it just the neglect of the fact that they existed? I think, you know, there are economic considerations to discuss about, you know, certain regions of the country that are really disadvantaged and, you know, what can be done there. And so I guess it's a cautionary thing for me that I think saying, oh, you're just an idiot, you know, doesn't really get us much of anywhere. I think that reckoning has to sort of take a step back and respect to a certain degree where these impulses have come from and asking how can we make sure they don't exist in future generations.
So I want to pick up that point because I think it's a really good one. I think, yes, there is certainly a dark, dangerous, racist streak among many Trump supporters, but that's not the entirety of Trump supporters. And I think if we treat them all as though they have no valid political space, we won't get the reckoning that Rosa so strongly and ardently and persuasively argued that we need. I do think there is something beyond race going on here.
Absolutely.
And it's about people who like the countries, leaving them behind, and that those of us who are political elites and economically advantaged by globalization aren't listening and reacting to their concerns. And I do think respect is a piece of this. And you're right to say we need to actually have conversations about what they're worried about. We need to explain what we have tried to do and why it hasn't served them and what we're going to do differently if we expect to be able to defang this rattlesnake.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. It's I mean, you know, you can be a racist asshole, but still have legitimate fear that is pushing you to be a racist asshole. You know, and I think we have to reckon with both.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, it's not just racist assholes, though. I mean, I think that there is a very substantial number of them in the United States, as there have been for a long time, a very substantial number of racist assholes in the United States. But Donald Trump has become and has embraced being a vehicle for racist assholes, anti-Semitic assholes, misogynist assholes, assholes without a particular orientation or a cause. He has a kind of developed this kind of pan-asshole alliance. And, you know, on top of that,
it's a big tent.
It's a big tent version of the party because there are a lot of assholes out there. But having said that, you know, you listen to this convention and it was remarkable.
Yeah.
You know, there was Ben Carson drawing a direct connection between Hillary Clinton and Lucifer, saying she was more oriented towards Satan than to God. There were people saying she should be thrown in jail. There was a Trump advisor saying Hillary Clinton should be hanged. There was a lot of underlying anger that the candidate seemed to deliberately inflame as means or as fuel for his campaign. I honestly say I look at this and, you know, this is almost a cliche at this point, but I've never seen anything like it on this scale in my lifetime. And I wasn't surprised when I saw a headline recently in which George W. Bush said he was worried he was going to be the last Republican president of the United States.
I mean, I think this is a question I've been talking about with lots of people over the last, especially the last week, but over the last couple of months as well. You know, where does the Republican Party go from here? You know, Rosa, you presented sort of this optimistic view of, you know, a reckoning. But specifically for the Republican Party, you know, does it survive? Does it fracture? You know, we've been a two-party system for so long, and so many other countries, which certainly have very different governmental systems. But if a party was in such a state of duress, it would break apart. And I think there have actually been a couple of like thought exercises done on the internet of, you know, if this were like the UK or this were wherever, like this is how the parties would actually break down. And I guess this is a question in part for Corey. I'm curious, you know, what you think this means long term for the Republican Party and whether it, you know, recoheres in some way or becomes something different.
OK, Corey, solve the problem of the Republican Party. We have a minute.
So I think there are two different paths based on whether Trump loses 48 states versus whether he, God forbid, wins or makes it a close election. If it's a close election, it will be much more difficult for moderate, reasoned voices to put this genie back in the bottle and try and address the problems that Rosa so ardently pointed out. If he loses 48 states, that's a lot easier, right? Because then boring, bumbling Jeb Bush sure looks a lot better in the aftermath of this forest fire. So I think it really depends on what happens in the election.
Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there, folks. I think Sayward's hit upon a point. I think there's certain stresses. I don't know if the stresses are healable. I've always felt that the biggest threat of the Trump candidacy isn't Trump, it's his supporters, and that they will not go away at the end of this. We don't have solutions for some of the things that are alienating them, which is demographic change in the United States, change in the way jobs are created, growing divisions economically in our society. We don't have easy answers. They're going to be around for a while. And if the movement that has placed them in control of the Republican Party continues, then a lot of people who are traditional Republicans are going to say, I want to go someplace else. My advice for them, form another party, call it the True Republican Party. That's TR. That's Teddy Roosevelt. Evoke Teddy Roosevelt. Evokes the, you know, Abraham Lincoln, and try to marginalize these others by playing more for the center. The Democratic Party has its own pull to the left, and there is plenty of room for somebody reasonable at the center in this mix. That's happened in a lot of other countries where this kind of thing has happened. It could happen again in the United States. Meanwhile, we can't keep going on and on here at the ER because you guys have got to finish your workouts. Several of you nerds have probably had heart attacks listening to this extra long episode on the treadmill, even though it was set on no incline and slow. But that's because, you know, you're nerds. But we're glad to have you. Glad to have your growing numbers.
And some of us think that you're very handsome.
Rosa is pandering to you. Some of you are handsome. Some of you, frankly, are not. In any event, you know who you are. We're grateful for your coming. We hope you join us again.
I don't know about this marketing strategy you're embracing.
Thank you. Thank you, Rosa. Thank you, Corey.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Sayward. Truth to power. See you again sometime soon. You have been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm David Rothkopf, and I've been your host. The program is produced by Maria Ori and Ann Kingston. For more information about FP and to subscribe to this and our Global Thinkers podcast, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get podcasts. Thank you very much for joining us.